All right, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study Regional Sediment Management Systems Approach webinar. My name is Carla Roberts, and I will be today's webinar facilitator. Today you will hear from several presenters discussing a variety of topics related to regional sediment management and a systems approach to coastal flood risk management. Following the presentation period, we will have a question and answer session. Although we will hold all questions until the end, feel free to enter a question at any time in the notes box on the right side of your screen. And please ensure that you send your questions to all presenters. You may also ask a question by hitting the raise hand icon on the upper left-hand side of your screen. But I will note again that we will hold all question answers until the very end. Also, please note that all presentations as well as the webinar audio will be made available on the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study webpage probably in early July. So before we begin today, I'd like to introduce Colin Wilcox with AT&T, who will be our technical moderator. Colin will now provide just a few remarks about the technical aspects of today's webinar and any additional notes about the question and answer period if I missed anything. Colin?
Okay, thank you. Like Carla said, my name is Colin. I'll be the moderator for today's session. Before we begin, please note that due to the number of participants attending the event today, the phone lines and voice over IP lines will be muted during the session to minimize background noise and to ensure that everyone can clearly hear the presenters. If at any time you experience technical difficulties, please send a note to me, the moderator, or you can go ahead and contact AT&T Connect Support at 1-888-796-6118. Again, that's 1-888-796-6118. And with that, Carla, I will turn it back to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin. I'd now like to hand it off to our first presenter, Ms. Amy Geis, who will provide an overview of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study as well as some opening remarks. Amy? Oh, actually, before I do that, I apologize. We do want to acknowledge our presenters for today's webinar. We have Amy Geis, who will be giving you a quick overview here in a moment, Julie Rosati, Matthew Bates, Candace Piercy, Monica Chaston, and Dave Robbins. So with that, I'll pass it back off to Amy.
Good afternoon. This is the last in the interagency webinar series that we kicked off as part of this study because it does cross 10 states. It was difficult to ensure that we were sending and sharing information across this area. Difficult to do that, you know, in a face-to-face fashion as much as we would want to. So we did kick off an interagency webinar series. We've had a very positive following with that, and so our background slides in the beginning here are limited to two slides this time because this is the last in our series. As we all know, this is a result of the impact of Hurricane Sandy in our region, which resulted in Law 113-2 in January 2013. Based on that public law, which gave authority and funding to several agencies, including the Corps of Engineers, one of the activities that was directed to the Corps of Engineers was to conduct a comprehensive study of vulnerable coastal populations that were affected by Hurricane Sandy, and we were allocated up to $20 million to complete that study. The catch was it had to be complete and delivered back to Congress by January 2015, so that was essentially 2 years from the date of enactment. The goals for the study are to provide a risk reduction framework for coastal risk management within that area that you see on the left-hand side of the screen. All of those areas in color are included in the study as the study area. And so it's to provide a risk reduction framework for coastal populations and shorelines in that area, which is over 31,000 miles. The other goal was to support resilient coastal communities. As we've learned from Hurricane Sandy and other events, it's very important to really understand resiliency as we plan for future events, particularly with respect to sea level rise, increase in population, and really even the demographics of our aging population. With that, I'll end the background on what sort of prompted the study, and we'll proceed with the topic today, which is the regional sediment management.
Thank you, Amy. So our next presenter will be Ms. Julie Rosati, and she will be presenting the Conceptual Regional Settlement Budget Overview Presentation.
Hi, everyone. This is Julie Rosati, and as Carla mentioned, I'll be presenting how we developed a conceptual regional settlement budget for the North Atlantic Division. And we do have a report. It hasn't been published yet. It's in review and revision, but we will be publishing that report probably within the next year. Next slide, please. Okay, what I wanted to do first is just talk a little bit about why we're talking about a systems approach, and that's really the focus of this presentation. And on the left, you see that the reasons that we're looking at a systems approach, it partly has to do with the large temporal spans that concern the coastal region, as well as the spatial scales. And then the different disciplines that engages, including the environment, economics and social. So you could have some stability in your environment, for example, but if your community, the social part, moves into an area or out of an area, those changes are going to affect how you respond to that area and how you protect it or maybe change the way you manage it. So there's multiple competing objectives between stakeholders, and that really points to the need for a collaborative approach and a kind of a decision that includes these different realms and recognizes the large temporal scales as well as the spatial scales. So on the right side, you see why we emphasize a systems approach. So it takes the broad view of the interactions and the objectives, and it develops a large range of potential solution sets that are addressed early in the process with all those different collaborators. And one of the things we're working at within the Corps is intentionally aligning engineering and natural systems. And I have a picture here of Deer Island Marsh, which is in Mississippi, which was breached during Hurricane Katrina and has been restored. And this project won the Environmental Excellence Award. It was a collaboration between the Mobile District of the Corps as well as the state of Mississippi and other agencies. And it was awarded for creative thinking, innovative design, and collaborative partnering. And those three things point to the benefits of a systems approach. The other thing that Deer Island did was use dredge sediments from the navigation channels in really useful ways. They used fine-grained sediments to build marsh, which is now being used to teach communities and young students about the benefits of marsh, and also the coarser material to create the beaches that you see there, and that's sort of a protective area, so that beach protects the marsh. And as a result of this project, they had the first ever documented loggerhead turtle nesting on this island, which had never been documented in the whole state of Mississippi. So it's really been a stellar example of how the systems approach and taking a really broad view of the needs of this area played into a really successful solution. Next slide, please. So now we move into the conceptual regional sediment budget. And truly, conducting a sediment budget is one of the very first steps to the systems approach. And a conceptual budget is the first step. It's the first look at an area to look at what information is available. So this was all conducted based on existing literature and existing studies and data that the Corps or other agencies had on hand. And it puts it all together, puts it all down on the map. And it's not meant to be the final step in how we understand the sediment sources and sinks in the area, but it's intended to identify areas where there's gaps in knowledge, perhaps where there's conflicts, where we have differing opinions about maybe the direction of transport or whether a particular area is eroding or accreting. So what we did was do all those things. We looked through the literature and culled the databases that we have. The Corps has one database called the Dredging Information System that's been in existence since 1990, and so it has data on all the navigation channels in the core. There's some placement information, although that's an area that we could definitely improve on in recording how we place material. We also just looked on existing morphology patterns from aerial photography or existing knowledge. This conceptual regional sediment budget extended from Virginia to Maine, and we developed it within a web portal. So that portal will someday be released for viewing and use by the public, and it can be overlain with, or it has been overlain with, the exposure risk vulnerability database that was developed as a part of the comprehensive study. And I won't go too much into that database, but you'll see it on the next slide so you can see what we did with the sediment budget. I just kind of end up like an introduction to the sediment budget. I assume most people know what that is, but I'll briefly cover it. It's basically, a sediment budget is an accounting of the sources and sinks that occur within a particular area. So you define a cell, which is the area that you have the sources coming into and the sinks leaving. So you can kind of think of it as a bank account, but it's a bank account for sand or for sediment in the area. So next slide, please. Slide 4 shows you the regions that we used in this study. We divided into 4 regions because we were on a really quick timeline, and we had we actually had 5 people helping us do this study. So there were 4 of us that did, each took an area as shown here, and then the 5th person worked on the dredging information, which was a big, big task in itself, just getting all that information about what the quantities were for dredging and then where we placed material. And then we also wanted to look at the type of material that we dredged if we had that information. So the region 1, I'll start with region 1, ran from the Virginia border all the way up to Chincoteague Inlet, which was a natural morphologic divide, and also coincided with the planting regions that had been identified in the North Atlantic study. Region 2 ran from Chincoteague north to Sandy Hook, New Jersey, and Region 3 was from Sandy Hook to the Connecticut-Rhode Island border, and then Region 4 went through up from that location through the Canadian border. Next slide, please. So what you'll see on these slides, I have 1 slide for each of the regions, and I'll kind of introduce you to these slides to start with. So what we see here are, you see the background is the total exposure risks vulnerability database that was established as part of the comprehensive study, and what you see is when there's an exposure risk vulnerability that's high, it's red, and then the lower values are green. So that database, I believe, has been presented before in a webinar series, and I won't go into it a whole lot now. But generally, what it's showing you is the areas that are more susceptible to damage, whether that's because of the population that's there, or perhaps because of the coastal condition that's there, or maybe because of cultural resources. So what we did was overlay our sediment budget with that database to give an indication of how those 2 types of information fit together. On the left side of the slide, you see our cells. You can see that we have cells identified for the navigation channel. You can see those are really, really long cells. And we also have cells identified for the estuary itself. And there's a lot more detail than you can see on this scale of a plot, and that's what's really nice about that portal that was developed, is you can zoom in and see a lot of detail, and then you can zoom out. So when you zoom in, you'll see the fluxes, which are the source coming into each of those cells and the sinks. On the right-hand side, what you see are those same cells, but you see the confidence that we have in the information. And the way we developed that confidence was, if we didn't have any information at all, the only information we had was our knowledge as coastal engineers and morphologists. We gave it a low confidence. If we had some kind of information, maybe a study or something like that, we gave it a medium level confidence. And if we had a high confidence, there was a documented study with pretty good background information that we could use to develop the cells and the fluxes. So In this slide, again, what I've done is identified the areas of high vulnerability or exposure. I'm just going to call it exposure from now on. So it's high exposure and a low confidence. So these are the areas that we could focus on and really make a leap forward in knowledge as to our sediment budget that would make a difference to the communities that are there. So for this region, we identified three areas that where we had low confidence in our numbers, and we also have probably pretty high susceptibility to damage for some reason in the exposure database. So you can see those shown there in this slide. Next one, please. Okay, so now we're on to Region 2, and we have the same kind of thing here with the exposure database as well as the cells and fluxes shown, although we're zoomed out so far you can't really see the fluxes. And again, the some areas of high exposure and low confidence in our sediment budget, or maybe because one of these areas is very erosive. And in this area, you can see we had a little more detail on the sediment budget as shown on the New Jersey coastline. There's a lot of information about transport rates and some studies that have been done along that coast. So what you see is we had some data on those cells. You can see that identified by they're not pink on the right side, that we had a higher confidence in those data. And the areas that are circled are where generally there's higher populations that are more vulnerable to future damage. And we could, again, make a big improvement in our knowledge of sediment budget and how we should manage our resources for that area. Again, our resources would be the dredging material that we have in the area and how we place that material. Next slide, please. Region 3, this area had a lot of information. This was my area, which I enjoyed doing the work for this area. So there's a lot of studies that have been done, particularly for the South Shore of Long Island, but also there's been some sediment budgets very local for the North Shore also. And so what you see in general, just some geologic terms, we tend to see that estuaries infill over geologic time scales. And that's what we've seen in all of these estuaries. Even the Chesapeake Bay one, you saw those were all infilling, they were accreting. You can see there's a lot of areas that are circled here, and that's because of the higher population in this area. There's a lot more people involved and areas that some of the less inhabited areas, like on the North Shore, shown by Montauk Point, inside of Montauk Point, those are more because we don't know a whole lot of information about that area. There really isn't any information about the sediment budget for that area itself. All right, next slide, please. And finally, for the Region 4, which was from Connecticut, Rhode Island border all the way up through to the Canadian border, a lot of the northern part of this area is rocky coast, which meant that we didn't really have a lot of erosion or anything like that. So we're mostly showing the southern part of this area here. Another reason we're showing the southern part is the northern part of this region didn't get really hit hard by the hurricane and didn't suffer as much damage as some of the other areas. But you can see that we did have some information for the Cape shown there, and that there were several areas identified that had that high exposure as well as a lack of knowledge about our sediment budget information. So those are shown here. Next slide, please. And this slide gives a summary of what we found. Unfortunately, out of almost 1,000 cells that we developed for the sediment budget, 67% didn't have any data. And again, as I said in the beginning, that's part of the purpose of a conceptual budget, is to help you understand where you don't have information. Most of the estuaries and bays did not have data. And that's an interesting point because a lot of the damage from Hurricane Sandy occurred from the bay. So, you know, that's probably an area where we have a big potential to improve how we manage sediments for our bay and our bay shores. Most of the placement data were missing from the budget. As I mentioned, that's an area that we have really can improve is, you know, where we place our material. We are doing a pretty good job in recording the volumes that we dredge But we're not doing so good in where we place that material as a function of the sediment type also, whether it's fine sediment or a coarser sediment. Overall, there was about 19 million cubic yards per year of dredged sediment that was documented in that dredging information study database that we have. In Region 1, it was about 6.3 million cubic yards per year. And these are just amazing quantities when you think about how you might be able to use this material beneficially to either build wetlands or put the sand on beaches. Region 2 had the most at 7.3 million. That's that New Jersey area from Chincoteague up to Sandy Hook, sorry. And then Region 3, about 5 million cubic yards per year. And Region 4, a lot less. And again, that's because it's more of a rocky coast and not as much sediment moving in that area. All right, the last slide, please. And this slide just has recommendations from what we learned from the study. One of the things we know we can do better is document both the sediment type and then how we place that material. Again, coarser sediments like sand, that's going to be useful for building beaches and dunes on the ocean side or perhaps even the bay side of some of our barrier islands. The finer silts and clays can provide estuarine habitat and wetland features in that area. And then rock, if we ever are dredging rock or very coarse material, we can construct structural reef and other kinds of natural and nature-based features. Again, an area that we can really improve is studying our estuaries because a lot of the damage did occur in estuaries and bays. We think we could really make a big leap forward in understanding the sediment transport pathways and where we can use material better by understanding how the bays are evolving and use the placement, the sediment that we dredge to better protect those areas. All right, well, that's all I had, and I guess I'll give it back to Carla.
Excellent. Thank you, Julie. Our next presentation will be from Candace Piercy with the Engineer Research and Development Center Environmental Lab and Monica Chaston, who's with the CORE's Philadelphia District. They will be presenting natural and nature-based features in regional sediment management.
Hi. My name is Candace Piercy. I work at ERDC, and I'm presenting basically just a run-through of some of the work we've been doing post-Sandy in the New Jersey area with various stakeholders. We're working with Monica Chaston from the Philadelphia District on several projects utilizing some of the sediments from some of the post-Sandy emergency dredging. We're also working with the Nature Conservancy and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with the Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge. So I wanted to walk you through some of the projects. Many of these have not yet gone to the construction, so we're talking about plans here, but really it's some exciting work, and we're starting to link together these projects and really embrace this systems context. Next slide, please. So just some basic background, which a lot of which I've said. ERDC is partnering with Philadelphia District and specifically Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge to help guide site selection and design of natural and nature-based features using dredge material. And these projects are really designed to increase the resilience of the New Jersey coast. So specifically habitat as far as the Philadelphia Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge sites go, but we're also increasing the resilience to some of the coastal communities in southern New Jersey. Primarily what we're going to be talking about here are going to be wetlands, but there are a few breach closures and island restoration projects and some beach fill projects that are looking at different NNBF. Next slide, please. So here's just a brief overview of some of the project sites that they extend from sort of the head of Barnegat Bay. A lot of the Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge is a huge area. There's little plots of land throughout the Barnegat Bay and Brigantine estuaries, and then extending all the way down to the Avalon Stone Harbor area, which are some of the projects that we're working with Philadelphia District and Nature Conservancy with. Next slide. So we're taking this concept of viewing our projects as a system. The map down below is a snapshot of Long Beach Island around Beach Haven, and you can see how all of these projects are related. We have a, on the beach side, we have a beach fill on Long Beach Island moving to the west. On the other side of the barrier island, we have Mordecai Island, which is a planning project that we're working with Philadelphia District on. And then on the landward side of the bay, we have Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge. So even though these are individual discrete projects, they all work, they're all within the same system, and they all work together to increase the overall resilience of the system. So for each of these sites, we need to look at how the oceanographic and estuarine forcings, our storms, our winds, our waves, affect sediment transport patterns and how those can impact our ecosystem and our infrastructure. Next slide. So looking specifically at the Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge sites, we're looking at sediment as a resource to improve their habitat resilience. They're seeing a lot of subsiding marshes. They have a lot of ditching in their sites, which affects the hydroperiod of their marshes. And they have a lot of historical impoundments and are affecting tidal flow and really impacting that habitat. And they're really embracing this concept of monitoring and adaptive management. So as the marshes are changing with rising sea levels, with climate change, they want to be able to know when do they need to start taking action on some of these sites that may not be in such bad shape now, but they really might be in trouble later on. So we have within Forsyth National Wildlife Refuge, they've identified several key sites they really want to examine, extending all the way from the head of Barnegat Bay all the way down to the Wildlife Drive, which is impoundment area, which is just west of Atlantic City. Next slide. I'll just walk you through a couple of those, some of their critical project sites. These are all their impoundment sites that they're interested in restoring tidal exchange, restoring sediment transport, and converting back to salt marsh species. Right now, some of these areas, especially Wrangell Creek and Dinner Creek, are basically devoid of vegetation. These were taken in May, so it's definitely the growing season. They want to convert some of these Phragmites and transitional species, invasive and transitional species, back to the native salt marsh that were. One of the key issues with restoring tidal flow to these impoundment sites is that we need to assure that we're not increasing the risk to our nearby communities, because there are adjacent neighborhoods to all of these sites, and we don't want out just for the sake of restoring tidal flow to our salt marsh. Next slide. We're also identifying some of these low-hanging fruit sites. So one of the critical sites, this is on Long Beach Island up near just south of Barnegat Light, is the Lovelady site. So this is a lagoon community that was developed, and they went in and decided to expand it, and went in and illegally dredged these channels before they were told to cease and desist. And now it's in the lower photo, you can see it's just sort of denuded marsh and open water. And this is one of those low-hanging sites. We can really use the sediment as a resource. We can go in and fill those dredged channels. We can add sediment in thin layer to the subsiding marsh and really improve the ecosystem function and provide some more protection for those houses that are along the edges there. Next slide. So the last are these critical thin layer placement sites that are really seeing a lot of wetland deterioration. I'll start in the lower corner. This is Wildlife Drive just west of Atlantic City. If any of you get a chance to go out there, it's a great view. It's a great little drive. They have the center impoundments they want to maintain because they are valuable bird habitat. But the wetlands that are on the outside of that ring road on Wildlife Drive are really suffering. They're eroding greatly. They have a long fetch. And they really want to do something to improve that habitat, not only to provide birds and fish and things like that with good places to raise their young and feed. But they also want to protect their road because there's a risk with open water being so close to that road that they may end up with future storms blowing out that impoundment and transitioning those impoundments back to salt. But the second site that they're really concerned about is Reedy Creek. So Reedy Creek site is just west of Mantaloking, and Mantaloking was a critical breach site, which I'll talk about next. So you can see how these projects that were inspired by different funding sources and have different goals really work together to improve the system. Next slide. So Mantaloking, which is just east of that Reedy Creek site, was breached during Hurricane Sandy, and it was one of the, Monica, you might be able to help me, I think it was one of the first response sites that Philadelphia District tackled after Sandy, is that correct?
Yeah, this was the smaller of the breaches that occurred up on Mantaloking, and it was in an area that the roads were completely devastated, and unfortunately the breach made the sand material go out into the New Jersey Intracoastal Waterway, so it also made a hazard in the navigation channel where a lot of people were coming to access the island. So we were able to get the government plant snail out of the Wilmington District. They were able to respond in early December and clear the navigation channel. And everybody worked together to take the material and pump it. So we got some quick permits and got the channel clear and the navigation mission restored and the material out to the beach.
And this is an important way to reduce the overall risk because if that breach had been left alone, which, you know, there's no way that possibly could have happened, but it ultimately would have been a weak spot that could have potentially impacted the wetlands that the barrier island is protecting. Next slide. So this is another beach fill project that's looking at how different funding streams, different sorts of projects can work together in tandem to increase the entire resilience of the system. So this is dredging August 2013. So they were dredging at Toe Island and trucked the material up, or not trucked, but the Currituck took the material up to beach fill template up on Long Beach Island. And that's the mayor there, right?
Yeah, he's kind of our poster child for RSM because this was, again, we were looking to clear the navigation channel by Toe Island, and he was desperate for publicly showing efforts and showing sand coming to the beach. So we were able to, again, use the plant out of Wilmington District, the Currituck, and take the material up towards the beach, and he was out there with his camera taking pictures, and it was a good RSM approach and a good way to show the flag.
So taking that material out, increasing the beach width, providing much-needed material to that beach that's ultimately going to help strengthen Long Beach Island, and zooming into this same area, next slide, is Mordecai Island, which is just on the back barrier side of Long Beach Island. So this is a great example of core internal collaboration. So those of us with the core know all too well that there are all sorts of competing interests. We're divided out into our specific roles. So generally planning and operations and navigation aren't necessarily always talking to each other, but this is a great example of how when we work together we can really hopefully accomplish something. So Mordecai Island is a ongoing planning project. It's been going on for years now, and their goal is to restore this island. It's been eroding significantly for a long time, and they really want to go in and restore the habitat and to provide protection for the yacht club and the boat slips that are on the island side behind Mordecai Island. I believe in the late 70s, the island has breached in that northern section has completely detached. So What we're proposing is to take the material that needs to be dredged from the New Jersey Intercoastal Waterway Island and pump it in that breach and really sort of close it up and provide, we'll allay the ongoing erosion until the planning project can get constructed because, you know, they haven't gotten all their permits in line and all the funding resources aren't there. But as this process is going on, the island's in, getting in worse and worse shape. So this is a win-win. We get to use the material. We don't have to go to the Parker Island CDF, which is rapidly approaching full, if not full. Monica, do you know if it's full or?
It's a very small CDF, and it's actually the wrong thing to do since it's sand material in the intercoastal. So just to add, we're hoping to actually construct this in the July timeframe. We have our request in for a water quality cert and federal consistency, so we're hoping to get that approved and get building this temporary restoration project until the planning project can come on in full force.
So hopefully if this goes through, we can get a win-win for everyone involved. Next slide. So this is another example of a great collaboration. We have a federal, with Philadelphia District, state Fish and Wildlife, and the Nature Conservancy NGO at Avalon and Stone Harbor for demonstrating some beneficial use sorts of projects. They're primarily interested in thin layer placement on subsiding and eroding marshes. So we have a couple shoals that need to be taken care of. Down at Stone Harbor, the southernmost point, it's just a 7,000 cubic yard shoal of almost completely sandy material. And Avalon, we have a larger volume, 75,000 cubic yards of fine grain material. So the Nature Conservancy and New Jersey Fish and Wildlife received a NIFWIF grant for a marsh restoration demonstration as part of, and part of their justification was to restore, abate some of the risk and provide some resilience to the populations of Stone Harbor and the borough northern borough Avalon. Next slide. So the whole marsh area, this is behind Avalon, is at risk for fragmentation under just 1 foot of sea level rise and with low accretion rates. We're gradually seeing the marsh sort of tear apart, and if you walk along that marsh, you can see, you know, these sort of subsiding pans and pools that are opening up. So the area is at risk. It's undergoing some habitat conversion and change, so this is a place where the material could really make a difference. Next slide. So along Avalon, we're proposing some thin layer placement. We can only get about a 300-foot extent from the edge of water, and we're only considering shoreline within 2,000 feet from the channel, at least from this last iteration. And we have to keep everything within the 1977 New Jersey Tidelands mark. So it can be a fairly tall order, but hopefully with everyone, we can, with everyone on board, we can sort of get through those regulatory hurdles and get something constructed, if not, hopefully this year. Next slide. So for Stone Harbor, the site further south, we have some sandy material, and this is a really small demo. This is a 7,000 cubic feet. We're planning to thin layer a little bit on the southernmost tip of this little point right adjacent to the channel, and then fill this larger pool that's in the upper right-hand corner that is at risk of breaching and further fragmenting the marsh. Next slide. Which should be our summary. So all of this work is ongoing, and some of our lessons learned is collaboration is key. We have to get everyone on the same page, or else someone is going to speak up further on down the road and put an obstacle in your way. Some of our challenges we found are constructability. Sometimes what's best for the marsh, what's best for the NNBF is not necessarily constructible within our budget and our equipment, and timing is proving to be a considerable issue. We need to monitor, and we need to get the word out for these successful projects and share that good. So hopefully small actions can lead to a large shift within New Jersey, and hopefully get some of operations and maintenance funding towards shifting to a BU rather than a rather than just our CDF disposal. I do have one question which I can answer really quickly, which what are the construction methods being used to get material to the sites, especially thin layer placement? So we are considering mostly pumping pipelines through there, and you can either use I believe the word jet spray is the trademark name, but you use the large pump to spray it about 300 feet, or you can directly place it through the pipeline in a nozzle and sort of let it spread out and settle out into these larger lower areas, if that makes sense. Monica might be able to explain it better than I can.
Yeah, just to kind of add to that, we are fortunate in that immediately, well, several months after Sandy hit, we were able to award a lease of plant maintenance dredging contract for the waterway. And what that does is we basically are renting a dredge and the associated equipment by the day. So it builds in some flexibility. And we've talked to the dredger, Barnegat Bay Dredging, that we have on contract, and he's willing to try some different ways to thin layer. And we've talked to him about that, and we've also talked to the state of Delaware who did Pepper Creek about the methods that they used to get the material thin layered. We have several other districts, including Baltimore District, that have done quite a few projects. So we're all working together, and we're hoping the Stone Harbor project will actually get demoed in August, and that should be kind of adaptively constructed. We're all hoping to be out there and use experience to get it built.
Okay, great. Thank you, Candace and Monica, for your presentation. At this time, we will move on to the next presentation, a systems approach to optimizing regional dredging, and that will be by Matthew Bates, who works for our Engineer Research and Development Center Environmental Lab. Matthew?
Hi, this is Matthew Bates. For the ERDC Environmental Lab, I work on the Risk and Decision Science team. And by risk and decision science, that means we try to take the tools of risk assessment, decision analysis, operations research, and other system perspectives and try to apply them to tough problems facing the Army Corps and our partner agencies related to civil, environmental, and water resources issues. So next slide. This is just generic background that everyone probably understands by now. Basically saying that dredging is important for the Army Corps. It's big business. We spend a lot of money on it, and it has great benefits in terms of securing access to commercial navigation and national security and recreation, and, of course, in this context, also coastal resilience. But being strategic about how we place dredge material can also be complex. There are potentially many different objectives that we need to consider and evaluate and make trade-offs between interactions between different projects, different sites. Not every site can take material at the same time or at a certain type of sediment and various other constraints, financial or otherwise, that we need to take into consideration. And next slide. And computer optimization is a way to really help take a big picture view of all of this in terms of finding an optimal solution, a most efficient solution that considers all of the complexity at a large regional scale in a way that would be difficult to do by hand or in the back of your mind. We can juggle a few constraints, a few interactions at a time, but really considering everything at once is quite difficult. So some of the multifaceted discussion that we often find with dredging and sediment placement is that you have multiple stakeholders, each with opposing interests. Some want an environmentally beneficial solution. Some want something that will look pretty or that will restore a community's beaches. Other people want something that's least cost. And all of these different objectives conflict in some way, and we need to explore that space of priorities and preferences, how it impacts decisions. Public concern over environmental effects. If we're talking at a regional scale, there's certainly high complexity in the number of site variables, and something like looking up and down the entire North Atlantic coast. And then our desire to use the material beneficially, but also to do so at a reasonable cost. Next slide. So that's where D2M2 comes in. D2M2 stands for Dredge Material Management Decisions, two Ds and two Ns. A software tool that the Corps originally developed several decades ago, and our team has recently redeveloped and added a new user interface to make it more useful and extended the functionality a little bit for our present needs. So basically, the question we're asking on the left is, what's the most efficient way to connect all potential placement sites with dredging sites that are going to produce sediment to achieve some set of goals? The dots in this case, with the circles with the D's in them, are dredging sites. The red triangles are placement sites. The orange one is a transfer site. And there's many possible links that you could envision connecting these different sites to one another. Which one should we use? Which is most efficient in terms of accomplishing my goal? Be that least cost, greatest environmental benefit, most likely to increase resilience, or some other factor. And how does that change when we consider time constraints, regulatory constraints, capacity constraints, constraints about material type or equipment, or other factors? And even further, how can we maximize efficiency across these trade-offs when we have multiple criteria, multiple objectives that we need to make trade-offs between, that we need to look at the priorities and preferences for them among the stakeholder community and the decision makers. Things like perhaps water quality, aquatic habitat, aquatic biology, various special interests, water birds, etc. Next slide. And so what D2M2 does is it gives you a format to enter all of your dredging sites, to enter all of your placement sites, and to enter all these details that are relevant for the system you're trying to manage. So that set of objectives, or that set of criteria, is flexible. You can define it however makes the most sense for the problem at hand. Typically, it would have some type of environmental and some type of economic and maybe a few other factors. And then you run it through the optimization, considering all of the constraints that you identified, all of the objectives that you identified, the different distances between the sites, the different impact and cost curves with every connection or every potential link to find the most efficient solution. In this case, this is just a diagram represented by the arrows, where either a large amount of material or a small amount of material is moving from every site to some placement area. And then just to preview some results here, what you might find is something like the chart on the right that shows the left set of bars, blue and red bars, show the solution, the total cost and total environmental impact. When you optimize that system with 100% weight on cost, minimizing cost, that is your only goal. And so that gives you a price per cubic yard and an environmental impact. But then you're able to, you have all that data in the system. You're able to quickly rerun it with a different set of objectives and really explore the trade-off space that exists for your system. So very quickly, if you wanted to have a discussion about what are the cost impacts of identifying the federal standard or a least cost environmentally acceptable solution, which is our goal with dredging material management for the Corps, but something that's not always well-defined or immediately visible. So you can, for example, say, I want to take that same data, that same system, and now I want to optimize it for environmental, minimizing environmental impacts. And that's what you'd get something like on the far right. So a much lower environmental score and a higher cost score. But it gives you numbers for these things so that you can talk about the trade-offs in terms of quantitative expectations instead of just qualitative beliefs. And then, of course, you can do any variation in the middle. Next slide. So D2M2, as a software tool, has three modules. One that's dedicated to optimization. That's where you enter all your site variables for your dredging and placement sites and your constraints, and all of your data for the region for the system. There's also a decision support module that's useful for doing ranking of potential sites. Maybe this would be used as a screening tool before you put everything into the optimization. And also a GIS plugin for Esri products and a standalone tool, or also an Excel template that can be used to help get data into the software. Next slide. So a few screenshots here. Unfortunately, they're all on top of each other. Just giving a view of what the software looks like. What you see on the top are some results from the decision support module. Next slide. And here's really the meat of what I want to talk about, the Long Island Sound case study. So this image shows the Long Island Sound region. New York on the bottom and left, Connecticut, top center, a little bit of Rhode Island on the top right. And the different volumes that are projected to be needed to be dredged over the next 30 years throughout the region. And then the next logical question would be, well, I have all of these sites that need to be dredged. I have some volumes I expect to need dredged. I have a variety of placement sites that I can use. What's the most efficient way to connect all my dredging sites to all my placement sites to most efficiently achieve my goals of either minimizing cost or some other set of objectives that we might work out with our partner agency? Next slide. So in order to work on this case study, we took a set of cost data that had been generated by the New England District for the Long Island Sound Dredge Material Management Plan, used that to create cost curves that we put into D2M2 as potential equipment and costs that could be used to connect each placement site with a dredging site. So now we have the map of dredging sites and placement sites. We have links connecting everything in terms of possible material could flow from source to sink. And we have cost curves for each one of those links. Next slide. And in addition to just cost, we're also interested in this case study and looking at effect, impacts and benefits. So the Long Island Sound Dredge Material Management Plan documents also identified a number of effects, environmental and otherwise, that had been considered, grouped into cultural effects, environmental effects, infrastructure effects, and physical effects, with various main criteria and sub-criteria for each one of those. Next slide. That we took, and it's hard to see here, but on the left, going down the rows in that first column is a list of potential placement sites. And then the main matrix with the numbers on the sort of center right are where we've given a score in terms of each one of the effects for taking material to that placement site. So taking material to a beneficial use site might have positive environmental outcomes. Dumping something in the ocean water might have negative environmental outcomes. Using something at on a beach might have positive cultural outcomes. Doing something near a shipwreck might have negative cultural outcomes, and so on. Next slide. So then we put all of this into the D2M2 model. It used that to as a system to strategically connect all of these dredging sites in the Long Island Sound region. So we've done that. We've added constraints in terms of which placement sites will and will not be available in different time periods and what volumes they're able to accept. Also entered a bunch of constraints coming from the DMNP documents for the various links by year and by volume and in a variety of details related to placement site acquisition, the costs for that, some lease details, operations and maintenance costs, potential for materials to be reused beneficially, and a variety of other technical factors. So this is the type of data that can be entered into D2M2. Next slide. So here's the screenshot of the Long Island Sound case study. So the blue dots correspond to the blue dots that we saw previously with the pie charts. Those are all the dredging sites that we included in the case study, each with a volume that needs to be dredged in each time period. The red triangles are all of the placement sites that are available to accept material. And some of those placement sites are limited in terms of total capacity or in annual capacity, where if material is placed there, maybe they need to rest and let material consolidate for a year or two before it can be reused. So all of those details are taken into account in the case study. Next slide. And so then we run the system to optimize either for lease costs, minimum impact, or split 50-50. So the results show the cost-centric scenario favoring open water disposal with minimal other beneficial uses. That's the least cost means to accomplish our objective of taking all the sediment from the places where it needed to be dredged to the places where it can be placed. And then we reran it very quickly using the same data, the same system layout, just a simple change in our objectives in the weighting. For the criteria to run an effect-centric scenario. And the results there favor beneficial uses with minimal open water or landfilling options based on a need to have additional volume beyond what the beneficial use sites might have been able to take in any given year. And then there's the 50-50 scenario that we ran with half of the weight on cost and half of the weight on effect just to further explore the range of solutions that we might have for managing the system. And that one, as you might expect, shows a mix of open water, landfilling, beneficial use sites, depending on the details of the data for each site, the locations, the cost, the effects, and how that those implications play out for each pair of sites. Next slide. Here's that result chart again. In the background are some of the reports that come out of D2M2 with the details and data showing material volumes that in the most efficient optimal plan would move from each site to each destination, dredging site to destination in each year by volume. And then next slide. And here's sort of a map of what those results look like. I have three slides here, back-to-back. The first one is showing 100% weight on cost, so this is the minimized cost scenario, then the 50-50 scenario, and then the minimized impact scenario. So here you can see the two columns going down sort of the center of the page that have a lot of white cells. Those are material volumes. Our Central Long Island Sound and Western Long Island Sound, two open water placement sites. So the bulk of material is going to open water placement in this scenario to minimize costs, with a few other uses based on, other cost factors and maybe a beneficial use site would be nearby, and so the cost of taking material to the open water site would be even greater than using it beneficially. In those cases, to minimize costs, we would use material beneficially a little bit, but mostly going to open water. Next slide. But then if we look at a 50-50 scenario, we see a bit of a mix. Some things going to open water and some things going to beneficial use sites. So we still see a lot of the central and western Long Island Sound sites being used, but also more of the other sites as well. So more things going, for instance, to municipal beaches, which is a beneficial use, or to filling in some brown fields and areas that required material for beneficial purpose, like the Flushing Airport on the far right. And then next slide. This is the third set of results that shows the bulk of the material going to be used beneficially, mostly to municipal beaches with a scattering of other sites here and there, and not to open water places. In being able to do this analysis quantitatively, based on all the specifics, all the details for your system, for the region, really gives you an opportunity to talk about the implications in a more educated way, to really look at what would be the cost implications of doing something environmentally beneficial. If I could do the most environmentally beneficial thing I could, what would that look like? Or if you want to add another criterion, if I could do the most resilient thing I could, if I could tie all of these placement sites to a resilient score from, for instance, Julie Rosati's slide shown initially, how might I optimize the system that way, and what would the cost? So that set of criteria is entirely flexible. Anything that you can quantify in terms of dredging sites, placement sites, and transportation links in between can be incorporated in the analysis. Next slide. So to conclude, that's an overview of D2M2 and the Long Island Sound case study that we did for the support. D2M2 is a multi-objective optimization tool that helps you identify most efficient solutions to regional dredging problems. Can automatically explore many thousands of potential solutions of different pairs of dredging sites and placement sites. Enables you to explicitly consider many objectives that are potentially competing and that you can think of in terms of trade-offs that need to be made, or priorities or preferences that stakeholders or decision makers might have. It shows the opportunity cost or benefit of using material beneficially versus open water or some other least cost solution. And it really adds transparency, replicability, and flexibility to the analysis. All of the data is put in one place. It's mapped out. We sort of know what the assumptions were going in and that generate the most efficient solution coming out. And it really enables easy scenario and what-if analysis, which I think is the most powerful capability, that once you've put your data into D2M2, it's easy to play around with it. You can say, what if I added a new placement site? What if we get a new storm and I need to dredge more in these sites than I thought I would? What if my cost curves are different? What if we could get some new dredging equipment that's more cost-effective to operate? And you can incorporate all of that into your what-if analysis and see how it changes the result. We think it's helpful in discussing trade-offs around the federal standard and what the opportunity cost is or is not of doing something environmentally beneficial, and it's useful for adopting a systems perspective for regional sediment management in particular and for increasing resilience to the extent that sediment can be used beneficially for that purpose. So that's all I've got.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. Okay, so the next topic we will touch on is public-private partnerships, and Amy Geis will speak briefly about that. I believe she has one slide here, so I will pass that back off to Amy.
Right, we just have one slide to point out that in the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, a lot of what was discussed earlier in the presentations, certainly there's a lot of engineering, decision-making, environmental considerations, cost considerations, and the list goes goes on and on. And so we recognize certainly that all of that science has to take place. But in the report, we also want to highlight the opportunity for P3, or the public-private partnerships. And really, in this systems context, and particularly in regional sediment management, it's a really ripe opportunity because in a lot of cases, because the sediment is coming from one location and maybe going to another, and because multiple agencies are involved, not necessarily all federal or state, we saw the examples with the NGO partners. This is also a great time to recognize what agencies have to offer that makes implementation possible that might not be cash. A lot of times our programs, including the core, require cost sharing, and we may or may not be able to enter certain partnership arrangements based on some of the rules. But this is an opportunity where the core, in this case, might have something other than cash to offer, and that might be clean sediment. And so we might be able to enter into an arrangement where we can provide that, or maybe provide the transportation for that sediment and get it to locations, whether it's on state land. We have some examples here in Baltimore where we're actually working on federal land installations that are on the shoreline, and their emissions may be compromised by future sea level rise or current erosion. And so it's a great partnership in a different way than maybe we've explored in the past. The study itself does not propose, you know, a how-to guide in terms of these types of partnerships. We recognize that, you know, it depends on the agencies involved. It depends on what resources, whether they're financial or other, that agencies are bringing to the table. But we definitely encourage not only the core, but others to explore these partnerships and really bring that forward so that we can see the systems approach carry through the various partnership arrangements. So we're excited to see maybe everyone rallying around this common endpoint, and maybe that brings us together to overcome some of the challenges or to work through those challenges in some of the innovative partnerships. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. And I believe the last thing we have on today's agenda is just a quick status update of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. So Dave Robbins, Project Manager, will provide a quick status update real quick.
Great. Thank you, Carla. And thanks again for everyone participating today. As Amy mentioned earlier on at the onset of today's discussion, this is the last installment of our webinar collaboration series with our stakeholders associated with the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. At this juncture, for those participating along the way with us, we're approximately 75% complete with the study. We've been working through the first two phases of our study over the course of the last 18 months. Recall, the first phase was to develop draft analyses to present to our stakeholders as part of our second phase, which was the interagency and validation and collaboration of those draft analyses. So at this point, several people on the call may have been participating as part of our stakeholders and received our draft analyses for input, and that occurred back in March 2014. We distributed electronically our draft analyses documentation to over 500 interagency staff, including federal, state, local agencies, federal, state, and local agencies, as well as our NGOs and academia. As a result, we received approximately 450 comments that we've worked to integrate into the next iteration of the documentation, which is our draft report. And at this point in time, our next milestone date is June 30th, where we'll begin the phase three, the final phase of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, where we'll be routing this draft report for review within our agency here, but also working with our federal agencies as well as other stakeholders, primarily with our federal agencies, to work through the legislative information system in order to get this document through our agency to OMB and ultimately to Congress to respond to the authorization language in PL 113-2 by January of 2015. So again, June 30th is the date for our draft report, and as part of our stakeholders, we'll be able to provide to them the draft report for their awareness as a courtesy to show how we've incorporated the various comments and feedback that we've received to date as part of our review, as well as participation during our collaboration series and other events. Ultimately, working through that draft report among all of our reviews, leading to a final report in September, and then with the routing of the final report, we'll go through our Office of the Assistant Secretary of Civil Works for the Army, and then ultimately through Office of Management and Budget, again, to deliver the report to Congress by January 2015. So, again, with that, today's discussion was the conclusion of our webinar series with our stakeholders. Again, we wanted to present a systems approach to address coastal flood risk and resilience, to address a lot of the issues that we've learned about today, including multiple objectives, multiple constraints among a myriad of stakeholders within constrained budgets, to really work with what's out there to address the risk that we know is increasing, and ultimately to promote resilience to address the next big storm that's going to occur within the region. So with that, I'll pass it back to Carla.
Excellent. Thank you, Dave. So that concludes the presentation portion of today's webinar. So we will now open up for questions and comments from our participants. As a reminder, to ask a question or make a comment, you may enter it in the notes box and make sure that you send to all presenters. Or you may select the raise hand button at the top left of your screen to be placed in the queue to ask your question verbally. So it does look like we have some questions in the notes box. So we'll go ahead and take what we had received during the presentation. The first, it looks like a comment actually, from John Haynes, and I believe this came in during Candace and Monica's presentation, but I could be mistaken. It says, on dredged material management decisions, habitat is a consideration. Archaeological sites and historic landscapes should be added. Any comments or anything from our presenters on that?
Sure. So the detrimental case study, not in the cost scenario, but in the effect scenario, we did include those factors. This case study, we used a bit of expert judgment in conjunction with the reports because it was done after the reports were produced. We didn't have quantitative numbers for all of that. But based on the reports and our interpretation of them, we're able to score cultural effects, shipwrecks, historic districts, archaeological sites, and environmental effects, which included wetlands, federal and listed species, state listed species, shellfish, federally managed species, submerged aquatic vegetation, marine protected areas, birds, marine mammals, and terrestrial wildlife, along with infrastructure effects and physical effects.
Okay, great. Thank you, Matthew. Our next question is from Mark Mariello. I was hoping that you would identify inlet sediment bypassing as an action that is long overdue in New Jersey. We have numerous tidal inlets with jetties that cause sediment surplus on updrift side to the detriment to the downdrift inlet shore. As a result, we continue to spend money on frequent nourishment of downdrift beaches. Bypassing has proven effective at mitigating the adverse impacts of jetty structures, restoring natural sediment transport patterns, and reducing the frequency and cost of downdrift nourishment. Can we expect support for this option as part of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study? Monica or anybody else have any comment on that?
Well, this is Monica. I haven't been actively involved in the study itself, but I know we have investigated sand bypassing at some of our inlets along the Philadelphia District coastline, and we have an active plant in Delaware. Construction, at the time that we did look at it from an RSM approach, construction of the plant itself can be costly, so it needs to be considered in a cost benefit. But I think I should defer that question to somebody that's been working on the study.
Steve, do you have any follow-up on that one?
Right. I don't know. Perhaps Jay might be able to speak to that. As far as sediment bypassing, that's obviously something that could be considered. But at this point, I won't be able to speak to that one. Maybe Jay might be able to take a stab at it. Or we could follow up.
Okay. Yeah. We can certainly follow up as well offline. So we'll move to the next. We've got more questions coming in, so we'll mark this one to follow up offline. Don McReynolds, how are you handling the cost-benefit analysis associated with the environmental restoration project with these P3s? Has the Corps paid for a project that might not meet the cost-benefit?
I would say certainly we're talking about our coastal risk management projects, and we recognize in the study that it's a range of structural, non-structural, policy, programmatic, nature-based, you know, all the these types of features are what we want decision makers to consider in reducing risk, and not just the selection of one or another, but actually the combination and blended solutions. So in that, and as part of the comprehensive study, we've done work, although not brief today in the webinar, we've done work on the economics side of the house in terms of expanding the pool of benefits, looking at secondary and tertiary impacts and how other social effects and other environmental considerations can be brought forward as benefits when we look at the cost-benefit analysis. I don't have the perspective from headquarters, Corps of Engineers, to know if the Corps has ever paid for something like this. You know, in terms of your question, that does not meet the cost-benefit as stated there. I don't know from that perspective if that's the case, but I do know that under this study we're trying to bring forward information such that so long as the alternative being considered, whatever that might be, so long as it meets the objective and there are a range of benefits that also come forward, which is why we were expanding the pool of benefits to be considered, that then it would pass that scenario or pass that test, if you will. And that would be the analysis we use for any alternative, whether it's a series of structural alternatives, structural versus non-structural, or other blended. We really want the full range of benefits to be considered.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Our next question is from Charles McKinney. He says, how do you choose, and this is, this is specifically to Matthew Bates. He says, how do you choose the value to assign to different kinds of cultural, environmental, or physical effects?
Yeah, so related to the last question about G2M2, in this case study, we used expert judgment in conjunction with the Coastal Material Management Plan report. So the reports didn't quantify all of these things. They discussed them qualitatively. So we read the descriptions for each site and then used our judgment to say that's relatively a little bit or a lot, a 1, 2, 3, or 4, either a benefit or an impact, plus or minus. But if we were doing this prospectively, we'd want to have the ability to have some scale mapped out going in to say, you know, these are the kinds of things that we want to measure. And to the extent that we could get numbers on this, do that before we use this for operation.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. Our next question is from Sarah Murdoch, and she says, question for Dave Robbins. In the recently passed WERDA legislation, a provision directed the Corps to incorporate project recommendations into the North Atlantic study. Will this be reflected in the June 30 draft or later? How will this be addressed?
Well, not Dave Robbins, but I'll answer. WERDA was passed, and it did have some direction about the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. In the actual text of WERDA as well as in the manager's report that accompanied it, and it provided some clarification on what project recommendation meant. How WERDA works with the Corps is that once that is passed, our Corps headquarters then issues, actually interprets that law for us, and they issue what's called implementation guidance and gives us in the field the direction on how to proceed. So There are two answers to this, probably both not extremely satisfactory for what you're looking for, but one is that we have to wait for that implementation guidance. We do know that we're working with folks on that. They obviously are very aware of this study. And so should that guidance come between now and, quite frankly, the delivery to Congress, then we would do, you know, what is asked of us in that implementation guidance. The other point I would point out that anything is it that's in WERDA is all authority. It's not linked to appropriations. So should anything in the entire WERDA, the Water Resources Reform and Development Act, should anything in there require additional funding, that comes through a different action from Congress. So in some cases, I don't know if this would be one of them, but in some cases the authority may be there, but the implementation guidance to the Corps may be that we don't proceed until further appropriations are provided. I don't know if that's going to be the case here, but that's how the two the Corps works between the authority and the Appropriations Act.
Great. Thank you, Amy. We just have a follow-up comment here from John Haynes. From his earlier comment, it was during Matthew's presentation. That was my mistake. I think I referred to a previous presentation, and he said his suggestion was not about the effects of dredging or impacts of beneficial use of the dredged material. I believe Matthew already kind of had some comments about that. Do you have anything further, Matthew?
So you can also, in D2M2, for each placement site, give it a relative score for beneficial use or any of the other criteria that you consider. So in this case, we did a similar sort of relative scoring thing. So it's like, you know, low, medium, high, 1, 2, 3 type of points that you accumulate. But if you're going to use this in operation, you'd want to quantify that in something a little firmer.
Great, thank you. At this time, we don't have any other questions in our notes box, and I don't see any raised hands. So just a reminder, if you do have a question or comment, please type it into the notes box on the upper right-hand side of your screen, send it to all presenters, or you can raise your hand by clicking the icon on the upper left-hand side of your screen. I'd also like to remind folks that the webinar slides and the audio recording will be made available on the Comprehensive Study webpage. That URL is www.nad.usace.army.mil/compstudy, C-O-M-P-S-T-U-D-Y. And with no further questions or comments, that will conclude today's webinar. So thank you all for your continued interest and participation in the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study.